Let's open up our Bibles to Genesis 37:14 today. We are looking at the story of Joseph now. Joseph is 17 years of age. God has gifted him as a prophet. He's giving him dreams and the ability to understand what these dreams mean. That's causing some friction between himself and his brothers, and even a little bit between himself and his father, because the dreams he's receiving seem to indicate he's going to be the most prominent member of his family. So much so that his brothers and his father and his mother, that would be Leah that we're talking about here, his adopted mother, if you will bow before him at some point. And that's hard for any of them to believe, and it's irritating for the brothers. They already don't like him because he reports to Dad when they are not behaving themselves appropriately in their jobs. They also know that Dad has him as a favorite, and they can tell that in one way because of the special clothing he has been given. So the brothers have been sent to the north from Hebron to take care of some of Jacob's flocks that are grazing near Shechem. That's a couple of days' travel north. And so Joseph is at home. He's in the tent city at Hebron. And Jacob wants to know how things are going up in the north country. So Genesis 37:14. He said to him, "Go now, see if it's well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. So that would have taken a couple of days, about 50-some road miles. And a man found him wandering in the fields. Now, why is he wandering? Because he's trying to find his brothers, and there's nowhere to be seen. They're gone. He's checking all the possible places they should be, and they're nowhere. And so the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" And he said, "I'm seeking my brothers. Tell me, please, where are they pasturing the flock?" And the man said, "Oh, they've gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" Now, Dothan is a city about 15 or so miles farther north. So that's another 5 hours walk for Joseph. So I wouldn't be a bit surprised if he spent the night where he's at and did that next 5 hours walk the next day. But he does. He says, Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. Now they saw him from afar. How can they recognize him? That coat he has. Either its configuration with long sleeves and a very long hem on it, or perhaps the fact that it's made up of multiple colors. So they saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. See, they are 2.5 days' travel from Dad. There does not seem to be any servants nearby that we know about. Joseph doesn't have a servant traveling with him. So these guys hate Joseph so much that they feel they want him dead and out of the picture. And this would be, in their minds, the perfect opportunity. They said to one another, "Here comes that dreamer. Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of the pits." So one of the cisterns that are nearby. "And then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams." So they understand he's presenting these as future predictions, that they will bow before him. So their answer is, if we kill him, how will we bow before him in the future? Kill him now, and his dreams will just fall apart as prophecies. But when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Cast him into this pit here in the wilderness, but don't lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father." So Reuben is the eldest. Even though he's recently disgraced himself in his father's eyes and lost his birthright and lost the blessing of the promise, that's now resting on Judah, Reuben is still looked up to by everybody else. He's the eldest. He's about 24 or so. So he doesn't want to kill Joseph. Why? Well, we can only guess, but I think it's a fairly decent guess, that he sees rescuing the favorite son of Jacob from being murdered by the other sons might get him back into good graces of Israel, might get him back on better terms with his dad, might even reverse, you know, the losing of the birthright. That's not going to happen, but you've got to think about his thinking process here. So he says, no, just throw him into the pit. Just leave him down there in the bottom of the pit. But don't kill him. Don't do it yourself. That would be a bad idea. Now, his intention is that later he'd sneak over, grab Joseph out of the pit, and take him back to dad. He's not going to get that opportunity. Now, before we move on, well, no, let's go ahead and move on to the next verse at least. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore. They took him and cast him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. So there's, it's a water cistern. It's a man-made water storage tank. But it might be the dry season right now. There's no rainwater that's got down into this. So it's effectively a great big hole in the ground where they can put him and know he can't get out. And what happens while he's in there? Well, we find out later he was bawling. He was crying. He was begging and pleading with them to let him back out. And they were ignoring all this. They turned a cold heart to him. Verse 25, then they sat down to eat. So while they ate, and Joseph made all that caterwauling in the background, we have new characters that come into the story. Looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Now, these Ishmaelites will be used interchangeably with Midianite in a little bit. And you shouldn't get too confused by that. It's probably a mixed entourage. It's probably a mixed trade caravan. These Ishmaelites, interestingly enough, are distant relatives of these men because Ishmael was their great uncle. So these are cousins a couple of times removed. The Midianites are also relatives through their great uncle Midian, another son of Abraham. And so these are all cousins a few times removed from the 12 boys of Israel. And the Ishmaelites and the Midianites have gone into some sort of trade alliance. They take the products that are unique to Gilead, which would be things like tree gum and balm that comes from certain plants, and myrrh also, that are from that area. So they take all of that material, which has got a pretty good trade price, down to Egypt, where they're going to sell it, and then they'll be able to buy things that are unique to Egypt and bring it back toward Gilead and probably sell it in Canaan along the way. So it's a really good trade loop. And this route takes them right past Dothan. And one other thing that merchants are willing to buy and sell would be slaves. People who owe money to other people. And those people don't want to wait until they work off the debt, so they find somebody else that will pay them the debt owed, and then they can have them as a slave and get their money back from them in whatever way they feel like. And in the case of the Ishmaelites and the Midianites, they'll just simply take their slaves that they purchased down to Egypt, sell them for a good profit, and then invest that money in whatever it is they want to buy and take back through Canaan as their trade goods. All right, so Judah, who is the legal leader of these boys now, he is the heir, because the first three boys have all disgraced themselves. Judah would be right around 22, I think, something in that neighborhood, 21 or 22. Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not let our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And so his brothers listened to him. So Judah says, "Guys, I got a better plan than killing him or letting him die in the bottom of this cistern. Let's sell him. Let's treat him as if he's a slave that owes us money and turn a profit." So he'll disappear into the slave population in Egypt, never to be heard from again. And we can come up with a good cover story with Dad, and he'll be out of our hair, and we aren't personally responsible for killing him. So verse 28, the Midian traders passed by. They drew Joseph up and lifted him up out of the pit, and they sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Now, this time they were using weights rather than coins as their exchange. But if the shekel kind of held its value from its weight stage to its coin stage, then we're talking about 40 days' wages here. I want you to think about a few thousand dollars, $2,500, $3,000, something in that neighborhood. So it's a good hefty sum. And so that's what they sell him for, and now he's gone. They took Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, "The boy's gone! And where shall I go?" So he comes back from wherever he's been. We don't know where he's at. He must have had to go take care of some sort of shepherding business. He comes back, checks the pit. The pit's empty. And that's when he tips his hand as to what he was going to do. He says, "What am I supposed to do now? I can't give him back to Dad. He's gone." So then they put into effect the rest of their plan. That is the cover story. So they took Joseph's robe, remember the very distinct garment, and they slaughtered a goat, and then they dipped the robe in the blood. And they shred it up for good measure, probably take some knives to it, and they're trying to make it look as if the wearer of this coat was attacked by a wild animal and killed. And so they all head home now. Remember, they're about 2.5 days away from home. So they get back to home, probably right away, because after all, Joseph was only there checking on them, and then he was supposed to return. So they need to get back to Dad with their cover story. Verse 32, they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, "This we found. Please identify whether it is your son's robe or not." Now, this is quite the twist on the deception. And remember, Jacob is known for having deceived his father. And now he's been deceived on a couple of different occasions, and now he's going to get deceived again. So there's this ironic twist in his life about deception. So they don't just come right out and tell him their cover story. Oh, Joseph was attacked by a wild animal. Instead, they just show him the ripped up special clothing and let him jump to conclusions. And it's blood soaked, remember. They want to let him jump to conclusions to the cover story. Verse 33, he identified it and said, oh, it's my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces. And that's exactly what they wanted. They didn't want to be tied in their father's mind to the potential disappearance of Joseph. With him assuming that the body has been drug off into the wilderness and devoured, then the coat is all that's necessary for proof of death. And so Jacob tore his garments and he put sackcloth on his loins and he mourned for his son many days. So he goes immediately to grief and goes through the ceremonies of sorrow that is part of following up a death of a loved one. He doesn't have a body to bury, but he can grieve over the loss of his son. And so all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, no, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning. And thus his father wept for him. So he doesn't want them to say it'll be all right. He doesn't want them to say, Father, you've got to get past this. Instead, he only wants to talk about one of these days, I'll be dead and I'll see Joseph again. Meanwhile, verse 36, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, and then the English Standard Version has the captain of the guard. New American Standard, which is one of my favored translations, has the captain of the bodyguard. This is one of those times I have to disagree with the mainline translations. But I always try to present you with the reasons for my disagreement with our English versions. The literal Hebrew at this point is the chief butcher. That's the literal wording in Hebrew. The chief of the butchers. The reason that our English versions go with this is because they are thinking about butcher being some sort of synonym for the killer of people. And so they just assume this must mean a military guy, somebody that kills people for a living. And so they make him into a bodyguard. I think the literal is intended. And so did the people who translated the Hebrew of this passage into Greek 3 centuries before Jesus, because they put that Potiphar was the chief chef or the chief cook. And so I am completely convinced, without a bit of doubt in my mind, that Potiphar was the head of food services for Pharaoh, that he was head over the preparation of all meals that were served in the palace. And so he wasn't just the personal chef for Pharaoh. He would have been in charge of cooking meals for everybody in the palace. And that would have been especially a big deal whenever there were banquets and such. So he is a high-placed person in Pharaoh's court, but he is all about the food. All right, so chapter 38 leaves the story of Joseph, because we've got to let him kind of be a slave under Potiphar for a while. And we're going to come back to him later, okay? After he's been a slave for a few years, okay? Now let's go to the story of Judah that's recorded in chapter 38. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and turned aside to a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Now, it happened at that time doesn't necessarily mean it happened after the selling of Joseph. It could have been a few years previous to that, because that would still be around the same time. And that's what I suspect, is that this first part of Judah's story happened before Joseph was sold. So Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. So Judah gets married to the daughter of a local man, a Canaanite. And she conceived, and she bore a son, and he called his name Er, which means awake. And so then she conceived, and she bore a son, and called his name Onan. And Onan means strong. So Judah's starting his family. And so these couple of boys might have already been born before Joseph was sold into slavery. Because I told you, when Joseph was sold into slavery, Judah was right around 22 or so. So if he'd gotten married when he was 18, 19, maybe 20, he could have easily had a couple, maybe three sons before Joseph was sold. Verse number 5, yet again she bore a son, and she called his name Shelah. Shelah means a petition, a begging. And I wonder whether or not Judah was begging God for something around the time that this boy was born. Wouldn't it be interesting if what he was begging God for was to be able to redo the selling of Joseph? Because you've got to imagine these men, after they saw the great grief of their dad over the loss of Joseph, they must have regretted their choice. We know later that they will feel that God is out to get them because of their choice. So they're going to be feeling guilt. So maybe, just maybe, Judah's wife, Shelah, was pregnant Judah's wife was pregnant with Shelah whenever the Joseph story took place. So Judah was in Kerzib when she bore him. So a little bit of an idea of where he was living when the baby was born. Verse number 6 jumps far ahead in time. And we'll want to finish this next week, but we'll get started on it now. Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. So that means that we've got to have it something in the neighborhood of about 20 years pass, 16, 17, 18 years or so before Ur is going to be old enough to get married. And Judah does what dads did back at that time, makes a marriage contract. It's going to be with a local girl, Tamar. But something happens to that first marriage. Verse 7, Judah's firstborn was wicked in the sight of he who is, and he who is put him to death. So God supernaturally executes this eldest son of Judah. He must have been pretty bad if God intervened. But there is a custom that already existed at this time. It was apparently intended to protect the rights of inheritance, and that would be very important since Judah is the heir of the entire estate of Yitzhak that will be coming through Jacob Israel into Judah's hands. And so the tradition was, if a son dies without having borne an heir himself with his wife, then the next unmarried brother marries the widow, produces the heir for that first son, and that is the line through which the property passes. And so when we get back next week to this story, we'll talk about how this really causes another big hassle amongst the family of Judah.